What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith, what a great resource this program is to get the answers that you're looking for. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us outside of North America, please dial the U.S. country code and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And of course, you can always shoot us an email. ctc@ewtn.com is the address to use. ctc@ewtn.com. Charles Beery is our producer. Ryan Penny is our phone screener. Jeff Burson is on social media. He can forward any questions you might want to pose via YouTube or Facebook because we're streaming there right now. Put your question in the comments box. Jeff will shoot that to us here in Studio One. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, good to see you again.
How many months has it been? It's been over a year.
I think it's been a year since we've actually sat at the same table.
I know. Well, you know, the old abundance of caution thing.
Right. So, right. Well, we're both vaccinated now.
We're all set.
You know.
So now, things are safe. And here we are.
And here we are.
So I'm very glad about that.
Yes, good to have you back.
It's always a little bit different when you're, remote. And anybody who's been on a Zoom call knows what that's all about.
Well, I much prefer the live event.
Definitely.
In the past, I do some public speaking for Catholic radio and conferences and things. And I had a couple invitations that got yanked when the COVID business happened. And they said, well, we're going to go virtual instead. And, man, I don't like the virtual. Because, you tell a joke and there's a delayed response. Wait 5 seconds for the laugh track to kick in.
Yeah.
And your timing is all off.
It is.
It's just, I like being live.
Absolutely. We're going to lead off today with a question from Luz, who says, I just recently came back to the church. I was away for 13 years. When I was a little girl, my aunt went to the Catholic parish in the Bronx to get my baptismal certificate so I could have my first Holy Communion. They were not able to locate it through their books, so they asked my aunt what day she thought I got baptized so that they could make up a certificate. Well, now I'm wondering if I was truly baptized. I then got baptized as a grown-up in a Baptist church. So my question is, do I have to get baptized by a priest at this point? Thank you, Luz.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate the question. So if there were adult witnesses to your Catholic baptism that could testify to that effect, and they testify that it was done in a Catholic church, then we would definitely presume the validity of that sacrament. Now, we do have baptismal certificates in the church to remove any doubt in the matter, but there are places in the world where, let's say, record keeping is maybe not always tight.
Not what it could be.
And the church does not take the approach that all these people have to be absolutely baptized or even conditionally baptized. If there's a pretty fair certainty that that was done correctly. Now, I would never advise anybody in doubt, to run away and get baptized as a Baptist. That's not what I would advise them to do. But baptism is valid. So if somebody weren't baptized a Catholic and they were baptized in a Baptist church, provided they use the Trinitarian formula and all of the other qualifications, that could be a valid baptism. But no, you don't have to go get baptized again. The first one in the Catholic Church took, and that was good. Now, there is a condition, there is a situation in the Catholic Church when there is a legitimate doubt about the validity of a baptism, the church can perform what's called a conditional baptism. And that's really the pastor's judgment, but I don't think it's applicable in your case.
Okay, very good. Luz, thank you so much for your email. Here's one that came in from Dante, who says, Dr. Anders, how long in terms of man's time Did creation really happen? Is the 6 days based on God's time but not in men's time?
Okay, thanks. So the Fourth Lateran Council says that creation happened, God creates all of the spiritual and temporal world simultaneously, and but that once creation begins, once the temporal order is created, God eternally creates a temporal universe.
Mm-hmm.
There's clearly a development of the cosmological order over time. Now, we're now dealing with a scientific question rather than a theological one. I mean, I think the astrophysicists and the cosmologists tell us the universe is, 15 billion years old or something of that nature. And clearly there's been development and change across the cosmos and the planets and formation of stars and planets and so forth. And that's perfectly okay for Catholics to recognize and respond to that scientific data. But in terms of God's decision to create, the actual act of creation is instantaneous. But then once he brings it into being, well, the world and the universe can change and develop over time in accord with his providence.
Very good. Thank you, Dante, for your question. Hope that's helpful for you. Lauren wants to know, how could the first Christians possibly have believed in the real presence when they had no concept of transubstantiation? They simply didn't have that category of thought.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Really appreciate it. Great question. It goes to the root of the nature of Catholic theology and sacred tradition. You would not believe in transubstantiation if you didn't previously believe in the real presence, right? So the Church wouldn't articulate the theory of transubstantiation to explain the real presence if it didn't already antecedently believe
right.
in the real presence.
Right, so right.
Lots of Christian denominations believe in the real presence and not transubstantiation. Transubstantiation is an explanation for the fact of the real presence. And what Christ taught was the real presence. This is my body. Real right. presence. This is my body. Now, what happens over time is that Christians who are firmly convinced of the truth of Christ's words, this is my body, well, they then begin to raise speculative theological questions. Well, in what sense is it his body? Is his body this way? Is it that
mm-hmm,
way? I mean,
mm-hmm.
maybe we got some bread with some body mixed in. Maybe it just symbolizes his body. Maybe like Calvin, I thought my bread's here, body's there. And the Church says, no, all that's wrong. When we say is, we mean is. Here's how we're going to define it, transubstantiation.
Very good. Lauren, thank you so much for your email. In a moment, we're going to get to the phone. So we've got a line open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. The Wednesday afternoon edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Stay with us. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. What is keeping you from becoming a Catholic? Let's talk about it at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. A great book out there now available from EWTN Publishing. It's called A Holy Hour with Mother Angelica. In 29 brief and brilliant chapters, Mother guides us with scriptural references and her own personal prayers, meditations, and intentions. Now, this book is a beautiful accompaniment to prayer in front of the Blessed Sacrament and also at home as well. And I've got a great quote here from Mother. She said, "I live because of the Eucharist." Well, that says it all. It's available right now at EWTNRC.com by Catholic. Shop EWTNRC.com. It's fantastic. All right, it's Call to Communion. We have a line open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. Meanwhile, here is an email from James. I have a friend who left the church because of the scandal of people in his parish. He says it doesn't matter what denomination he is, because God won salvation for all who believe in him based on John chapter 3. So what is a way to approach him about why he should return to the Catholic Church, even though we believe that he can go to heaven as long as he believes?
Okay, thanks. So we don't actually believe that. We don't think that he can go to heaven just as long as he believes. That's the error of Luther, the so-called justification by faith alone.
Mm-hmm.
Belief is in God is necessary. We need to know that God exists and that he desires certain things for us and from us, and that there are things we need to do in life according to God's will. We need to believe those things to tread our path, so to speak. But the condition for making it into heaven is that we love God above all things and love our neighbor as ourself. There actually has to be an ethical, moral change in our interior life. That's the condition for salvation. Christ talks about this all the time, that he rewards certain good behaviors. Pray in secret. Your Father in heaven who sees you in secret will reward you. Give alms in secret. Fast in secret. Your Father who sees you will reward you. On the last day when Christ separates the sheep from the goats, the criterion is the corporal works of mercy. Did you feed the hungry and clothe the naked and so forth? So it's not sufficient just to believe. Now, the question of denominations and religious affiliation, why pick one church over another? Well, I've just given you one reason. What if your friend leaves for a church that teaches him all he needs is faith alone? And so he begins to neglect the care of his soul and of his interior life and the care of his neighbor,
mm-hmm.
because he becomes presumptuous about the question of salvation. He's told all you got to do is believe. Well, that might be the worst thing possible for him.
Yeah.
And as one of the many reasons to be Catholic is only the Catholic Church has the fullness of truth taught by Christ, because they have sacred scripture given to us by God by inspiration, but also sacred tradition handed to us by Jesus and the ongoing guidance of the Holy Spirit in the Church's sacred magisterium to confirm for us the deposit of faith, so we don't get confused about what we have to believe and not believe. That's one of the major reasons to be Catholic, the certainty of the content of the faith. Another reason to be Catholic is the fullness of the means of grace, all seven sacraments given to us by Jesus as the ordinary means of participating in Christ and in the divine nature. If he leaves the Catholic Church, he probably will leave most of those sacraments behind him. Well, Christ says, if you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have life. Well, if he leaves the holy priesthood and apostolic succession behind, he won't have the Eucharist. He won't have the body and blood of Christ given to us for our salvation. He'll be restricted to baptism and marriage. No, those are great sacraments. But Christ didn't just give us two sacraments. He gave us seven. We need all seven. And I could go on and on.
Okay. Hey, James, thank you so much for your email. We do appreciate that. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, here is the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. If you're ready now, let's get to those phones at 833-288-EWTN. We begin with John. John is in Buffalo, listening on ewtn.com, a first-time caller. Hello, John. What's on your mind today?
Good afternoon. I was telling the screen that I'm engaged to a lady from Indonesia, and she was married in a Catholic church in Indonesia and divorced her husband in Indonesia because of infidelity. Now, she came to the United States over 20 years ago. She's a born-again Christian now, and we're trying to get married in the Catholic church, but the priest that is in my church says that we have to have proof of her annulment. Indonesia is not supplying anything like that to a Catholic. That's a Muslim country. They don't want to hear about, you know, other people's religious problems.
Mm.
And, you know, we're trying to go about this the right way. She's getting very upset behind it. I'm getting a little aggravated myself. I'm a knight to the Immaculata. I'm a cradle Catholic. But I will get married in the Protestant church if my hand is forced, because I want to get married in front of the clergy. I don't want to get married in front of the judge.
Okay, John. I'm gonna try and help you best I can. I appreciate the call. I'm sorry for your difficulties. So first of all, you don't need any information from the state of Indonesia, from the government of Indonesia. You're right. It's a Muslim country. They got nothing to do with your sacramental marriage. However, that's not who you need information from. You need information from the Catholic diocese in Indonesia that would have granted her an annulment. Did she, in fact, obtain an annulment in Indonesia 30 years ago?
She's told me that when you get a divorce in Indonesia, it's like you get a newspaper article, and that's it. It's
okay, well, this has got nothing to do with the government of Indonesia. See, in the Catholic faith, Jesus taught us that Christian marriage is permanent, is indissoluble. You cannot divorce and separate from your wife for any reason in the Catholic Church. You may have to live apart, but you don't sever the lawful bonds of matrimony. If you're joined as Christians, that bond is indissoluble, cannot be broken. That's the teaching of Jesus in Matthew 19. So if somebody believes themselves to be married as a Christian and they wish to separate from that individual and marry someone else, there's only one path to make that happen. And that is the individual needs to prove to the church that that first relationship was not a valid marriage. It's not the same thing as a divorce. It's actually establishing that you weren't ever really married to begin with. Now, a lot of people think they're married and they're not married because there's something lacking. There's some impediment to their being validly married. And what an annulment is, declaration of nullity, is the church deciding that that first relationship wasn't really a marriage at all. And so if you marry somebody who does not have an annulment, somebody who has been married before, their spouse is still living, and they don't have an annulment, then you're really forcing that person into the situation of being an adulterer or an adulteress or a bigamist, right? Because they're representing that they're already married to somebody else. Yeah. Civil divorce doesn't eliminate that, right? So you're not going to be able to solve this problem through the Indonesian government. The church is going to have to be your guide here. And I strongly urge you not to marry in front of a Protestant minister, because if you do, that will not be a valid marriage for you. Since you're Catholic, you have an obligation under the church's law to marry in the Catholic Church in front of a Catholic priest or deacon, unless you get a dispensation from your bishop. That'll be an invalid marriage and therefore immoral. And so I know it's difficult, and I'm really sorry that for the troubles, and the fact that this thing took place in Indonesia just complicates it even further. It does. You have a higher bar, a greater burden than most people. And in God's providence, he has allowed this trial to come into your life. But no temptation overtakes us such as common to man, and God will provide a way out. Now, it might take a while. And that, you know, that impatience and that longing and that frustration, all of that is fodder for your spiritual growth and development and virtue and patience and hope and trust in God and his providence. But to go and do something unlawful and marry outside the church is not a solution to your problem. It's just compounding the difficulty that you'll have to deal with down the road. So, my suggestion is you go to the priest and you say, look, we don't know how to proceed here. You've really got to help us. You have to. I mean, I've known priests that, like, give me the paperwork. I'm doing it for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, your guy may not do that, but you need to get an advocate in the church who understands the church's law, who can help walk you through this, right? Because it's evident to me you haven't gotten enough information from the church on how to move forward, and you need to really request that. I need someone to help guide me through this process because I don't know what I'm doing, and we're not going to get this completed unless somebody from the church helps me. Now, if you don't get help from your pastor, my next recommendation would be to reach out to the diocese, reach out to the bishop's office in your diocese, and say, I need help understanding how to determine whether there is an annulment or to get an annulment if we don't have one already. And that's what you need. You need somebody in the church who's an expert in the law to really guide you.
God bless you, John. Thank you so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We're going to stay in New York and go from Buffalo to Long Island. Go to Joseph in Long Island, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Joseph, what's on your mind today?
Hi, good morning. Actually, good afternoon. I'm sorry. My question is, how do I explain to my Protestant brothers why we offer, and I'm glad we do still, offer sacrifices of the Mass?
Yeah, because Jesus commands it. That's why. Jesus commands it. And you remember in John chapter 4, when the woman the Samaritan woman at the well, says to Christ, we worship here and you Jews worship there. And Christ says, I tell you, woman, a time is coming when God's worshipers, true worshipers, will worship him neither on this mountain nor that, but in spirit and in truth, when the Messiah comes. And, well, what is that worship in spirit and in truth? Well, you flip over in your Bible a little bit to Romans chapter 12. St. Paul says, offer your bodies as living sacrifices. Offer your bodies as living sacrifices. This is the worship in spirit and in truth. The spiritual act of worship, or rational act of worship, he says. And so to offer something to God is the principal act of Christian worship, commanded in the New Testament as well as the Old. And imagine declaring your love for a human being, maybe your wife, and you said, I love you, but I ain't going to do anything for you. I will not lift one finger on your behalf. Ooh. But I love you. I'd like some favors, though. Let me give you my laundry list. Here's my list, but I'm not lifting a finger for you. You say, that's not love at all.
No.
Right? And so self-donation, to offer something to God, is the essence or the expression of what it means to love and also to worship. Now, Protestants rightly note that the New Testament, especially the book of Hebrews, teaches us that Levitical sacrifices and offerings, the sacrifices of the temple in the Old Testament, are done away with. Yes, they are. They are gone. So I strongly dissuade you, do not bring goats, bulls, or heifers to church.
There's no future in that.
We are not slaughtering agricultural animals at the doorstep of the Catholic Church and offering them up. No, we're not doing that, okay? But that God has appointed a sacrifice for the Gentiles, for us Christians to offer to God, was indicated prophetically in the book of Malachi. When Malachi says that the Gentiles will offer to God a pure offering. And that is the Holy Eucharist. It is the offering of Christ's body and blood in an unbloody manner. That's really important to emphasize. We do not kill or crush destroy Christ in any way. All right, this oblation is an unbloody one. All right, we do not immolate Christ. He died once on Calvary. He doesn't die again. But in an unbloody manner, we offer the body and blood of Christ, along with our own prayers, works, joys, sufferings, and sorrows, to God in the holy sacrifice of the Mass, because Christ commanded it. Do this in memory of me. And the language in the words of institution, in the in memory business, it's not just, well, do this and think about me. You flip over to Acts chapter 10. Very same language, very same Greek word is used when the angel appears to Cornelius and says, your prayers and gifts to the poor have come up before God as a memorial offering. So the note of sacrifice is built into the very language of the institution narratives from the Gospels. When Jesus says, do this in memory of me, you could just as easily translate that, offer this as a memorial sacrifice. My body and blood, present in this mysterious sacramental mode, and with it, your very selves. This is the principal act of Christian worship.
Okay. Joseph, thank you so much for your call from Long Island. It's called to Communion here on EWTN. We have a line open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Albert is watching us on YouTube in Malta, the island of Malta. How about that? He says, evangelical Protestants claim that Catholics are not saved, in quotes. What does this mean, and how can one rebut this accusation?
Yes. So in Protestantism, in the history of Protestantism, a strange theology emerged in the post-Calvinist wing of Protestantism. John Calvin was the first theologian to argue that the sacraments are effective to bring grace into your life sometimes, but not in everybody, right? The standard Christian position, the biblical position, the Catholic, even the Lutheran position, is baptism, for example, always works. If you're baptized, you're incorporated into Christ, period, end of paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Calvin introduced a wrinkle. John Calvin, Protestant theologian, he said, well, some people are incorporated into Christ through baptism, but only if they were elect by God, chosen by God ahead of time.
Mm.
So it works in some people, it doesn't work in other people.
Uh-oh.
Well, that set up a problem for Protestants. How do I know if I'm one of those in whom baptism worked? Now, the resolution of that problem, well, so-called resolution in Puritanism, is going to give us the answer to your question that I'll get to after the break.
All right. Sit tight, Albert, in Malta. We will continue this question in just a moment here. And we have a line open for you if you have a question for Dr. David Anders, or you'd like to tell us what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic. Call now, 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. Hey, what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Let's talk about it here on Call to Communion on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We also hear from people from time to time who say, well, look, I'm a Catholic and I'm very happy about it, but I've got a coworker who's got some questions. We can help with those as well. 833-288-3986. Okay, before the break, David, we were tackling a question here from Albert on the island of Malta, who said, evangelical Protestants claim the Catholics are not saved. What does this mean? How can one rebut this accusation?
Yeah, so I gave a little history of Calvinism, which is a brand of Protestantism, and Calvin's unique contribution, so to speak, to Protestantism was to introduce doubt about the efficacy of the sacraments. So he said it works in some people if you're elect, and it doesn't work in other people if you're not elect. And so Puritans began to really get upset about the idea, how do I know if I'm elect or not? But he also suggested, Calvin, that a person could know for sure that they were elect, know for sure they were going to heaven. Now, well, it really wasn't characteristic of Luther, and it certainly wasn't true of early Christianity or the Catholic Church. So he really created a psychological burden for people. On the one hand, he said, you really need to know for sure you're going to heaven. Right? That's a very important question. And you might not be, even though you're a believing Christian and you've been baptized.
Oy.
All right? So Puritanism was all about trying to set up all these tests to discern, am I really one of the saved or not? Am I really one of the ones that's going to go to heaven? And they had a lot of different so-called solutions to that pseudo-problem. But they eventually, in the 18th century, settled on one, right? And that was the idea of having a kind of crisis conversion experience. That, you know, you hear an evangelistic message and your heart is strangely warmed and you feel overwhelmed to respond to this. And by the 19th century, that took the form of sort of making a declaration for Jesus. Charles Finney is the guy that really introduces this spirituality to the Protestant world, you know, sort of standing up at an altar call and going, you know, I'm in on the game. And then D.L. Moody in the late 19th century adds another wrinkle. He adds the idea that you can actually recite a written prayer or a set formula along the lines of Jesus, come into my life and save me. And boom, that's how you know for sure that you're going to heaven. And so this is a very late development in the history of Protestantism, right? This whole idea of being able to pinpoint a moment in time when I made a decision or I read a prayer or I made a statement, and that sort of marks me as one of God's elect. It's a very late development in Protestantism, but it has become very, very dominant in the evangelical mindset throughout the world, so much so that Protestants who do not know their own history just assume that that's the way it's always been for 2,000 years. They don't know that this spirituality is only 100, 150 years old. Right.
Wow.
But that's the idea. That's where it came from. This idea that to be quote unquote saved is to be able to mark out some specific moment in time when you had some crisis conversion experience or you prayed a particular prayer. Now, and so naturally, if that's what you think Christianity is, you turn around, and you look at Catholics. Now, Catholics have been doing the same thing for 2000 years since we got it from Jesus. And I would challenge anybody to read the words of Jesus and look for, you know, a Billy Graham crusade or D.L. Moody's little prayer. You're not going to find the four spiritual laws or, you know, a little evangelistic track in the teaching of Jesus. That's not how he does it. Christ actually calls for the conversion of life, to follow him as a disciple. If you want to be my disciple, take up your cross and follow me unto death. And a change of life that would be evidenced in living the Beatitudes and in the corporal and spiritual works of mercy, at the end of which time we stand before God's judgment. That's the way Christ articulates it. Mm-hmm. So Jesus' teaching is not pray this prayer and be saved. Jesus' teaching was whoever perseveres to the end will be saved. That was Jesus' teaching. Well, that's Catholics, that's the way we've been believing. We've been believing as Jesus taught for 2,000 years. So here comes a Protestant fellow who says to the Catholic, are you saved? The Catholic scratches his head and thinks, well, I hope not, because that means I'm dead. Christ said I had to persevere to the end. I was kind of hoping to catch that movie on Saturday night. You know,
funny. That's funny.
I don't want this to be the end, right? and so they're really speaking different languages. You know, the Protestants operating in a completely different theological paradigm. So, oh, that Catholic guy's not saved because he didn't pray my little prayer that we wrote, you know, 10 years ago. And the Catholic guy is thinking, I don't know what you're talking about, you know, and that's how they're talking past each other.
So there you go. Albert, thanks for listening to us on Malta. Very impressive, and glad that you're watching today on YouTube. Call to Communion here on EWTN. I'll tell you what, we have a line open for you right now. If you call, we'll get you on the air. If you don't call, we're not going to get you on the air. That's kind of how it works here. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Clay is watching us on YouTube as well. Clay says, what are some philosophical reasons for believing in the afterlife?
Yeah, thanks. So when it comes to the afterlife, I like to begin with the question of the immaterial soul. Right? That's really where you have to start. And then from the fact of immateriality, you infer incorruptibility,
yeah,
right? Because you can't have corruption in an immaterial thing. I mean, I should try. Try to corrupt number two, you know, or number 75 or something. Yeah. The abstract entity, you can't, it doesn't corrupt. It's immaterial. It's
right.
Eternal, right? And so the real question, how do you get to the immateriality of the soul? What you look at its operations. And the way I know that the nature or essence of something is I observe it in its operations. The dogginess of my dogs is evident from their barkiness and woofiness and wagginess, okay? And then I infer their dogginess, their dog nature. Well, look at the operation of the human soul. Well, it has, you know, vitality the same way an animal soul would, and nutrition and growth and all those features of animal life. But it has other properties that seem not to characterize animal life, like intellectuality, the power of abstract reasoning and rational choice to deliberate between rationally conceived goods. None of those are properties of matter. They're properties of the immaterial. Right, the abstract, absolute good, evil. These are not properties of matter as such, and so we can discern the immateriality, the spirituality of the human soul, and from there infer its incorruptibility.
Okay, appreciate that. Thank you so much, Clay, for watching us today on YouTube. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Looks like a couple of lines open at the moment. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Stephen says, I have encountered quite a few women, my daughter and granddaughter included, who are adamant in the view that women should be allowed to enter the priesthood. Some of these women are young and devout Catholics. Can you please explain and advise me how to convey to them why this is not possible?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Well, I can answer this at any number of levels. I mean, the simplest, but it probably the one that's least likely to satisfy, is because this is what has been laid down definitively by the Church's sacred tradition and teaching authority. John Paul II wrote an apostolic letter, apostolic constitution, Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, I think, was the name of the document, where he said, you know, in his capacity as the successor to St. Peter, in order to bring certainty on a matter that, you know, where there was some doubt in some quarters, he declared that the Church has absolutely no power, period, end of paragraph, to ordain any but men to the sacred priesthood. It was the closest thing to an infallible dogmatic declaration that you could possibly get without him actually using the words, I infallibly declare. And theological opinion on this is that the teaching is infallible by the ordinary magisterium of the Church, right? So it's you look at sacred tradition, sacred custom. For 2,000 years, the Church has never done anything but ordain men, right? And it has never been in question in the Church's practice. So the weight of sacred tradition is overwhelming. I mean, if you think about it, there is far more dispute historically over the question of the divinity of Christ, which is a central dogma of the faith,
yeah,
than over the question of the ordination of men.
Really?
And when was there ever a historical controversy over the ordination of men? Not until the feminist movement of the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
Right? So, I mean, it's just the always, everywhere, and by all teaching of sacred tradition and the sacred magisterium. And every pope that has addressed the question since modern feminism has ruled in precisely the same way. The example of Christ and the apostles and the explicit instructions the apostles and Christ give concerning future ordinations are always to select men. Who have a certain kind of quality of life and so forth for the sacred office. So it's positively taught in Revelation, sacred tradition, and the teaching authority of the Church. So it's really non-negotiable. Now, the question, but that's not very satisfying to someone who has been nurtured in a kind of feminist sensibility and thinks that, you know, anything you can do, I can do, and we should all be able to take one another's roles and so forth. And so we have to try to render that verdict of revelation intelligible, make it sensible. And the way to do that is to begin by recognizing that men and women are equal in dignity, but different. And there are plenty of things that women can do that men can't do, and that women ought to do for the good of the church, and that men can't do. I mean, I can't go be the mother superior of a convent.
I wouldn't recommend it.
It ain't going to happen.
No.
Right? And it'd be highly inappropriate. It's not like I couldn't perform the functions. I could perform the functions. I mean, I could render judgments, and I could set policy, and I could move people around in their jobs, and I could spend money and save money and build buildings. And
can you sing, "How Do I Solve a Problem Like Maria"?
Badly.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, I could do the functions of a Mother Superior, but I mean, but I can't be a Mother Superior.
Right, of course.
And I can't be a physical mother either, right? Yeah. Any more than my wife can be a father. Now, the priest is in the church as a father to a family and a husband to a bride, right? And so that is some, only a man can be a father or a husband. Now, there is also a motherly role of leadership and guidance and governance and authority and importance in the church, but that's not the sacred priesthood.
Yeah.
That's other functions in the church. And it's essential that we have women in those positions of leadership and guidance and governance. For example, I don't think any man could have founded EWTN and taken it to where Mother Angelica took it.
Yeah.
I think you had to be a woman, and you had to be a woman religious, and you had to be her to do it, right? No, I couldn't do it. Tom couldn't do it.
No.
Doug Keck couldn't do it. Michael Warsaw couldn't have done it. No man could have done what Mother Angelica did, and her femininity was integral to her mission, and she'd be the first person to tell you that.
Sure.
And there, Mother Teresa. No man could be Mother Teresa. And who has more power and authority in the 20th century Catholic mind than Mother Teresa for spirituality and the example of holiness and maternal spirituality? Mother Teresa. Tremendously powerful woman. But as a woman, not as a man.
Okay. Appreciate that. And thank you so much for your email, Stephen. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. Don't forget to join us tomorrow for Take Two with Jerry and Debbie. That'll be at noon Eastern here on the network. Jerry and Debbie want to know, and this is a great timely question here, who is someone who has helped you during the pandemic? You may have somebody in mind. Give us a call tomorrow and be sure to join us for Take Two with Jerry and Debbie at noon Eastern, only on EWTN Radio. Let's go to Diana now in Corona, California, listening on Sirius XM 130, a first-time caller. Hey, Diana, what's on your mind today?
Hi. So I have some neighbors who are Protestant, and they kind of bounce from church to church. But now they've started their own church at their house, like in their backyard. And they've invited me, and I just say, no, thank you. But I'm like, what can I say to them? Or is there a book or something I could recommend to explain to them why you can't just go start your own church?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, there's a lot of resources in Catholic theology and apologetics to defend the doctrine of the church, of the papacy, of the bishops, apostolic succession, and the sacraments, all of the reasons why it's not up to us to begin another church other than the one that Christ founded. The question, what's the best way to approach your neighbors about this? I don't know that going next door and telling them to stop it would be the most effective means, right? Because they're not going to stop because you or I tell them to. I think probably the best thing to do is to befriend them and to, by your love and charity and faithful witness to your Catholic faith, let them see that you are a true believer in Christ and that your commitment to the church and to the sacraments and to the apostolic office bears fruit in your life that they need, right? And be open to them in such a way that they feel free to ask you questions about your faith and you prepare to answer them. I have had Protestant friends and neighbors do things that I thought were, you know, not in line with the teaching of the church, and have waited patiently for, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years sometimes for the right opportunity to share my faith.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're ready, I share. Right, but you know, don't feel the need to go over there and proselytize,
right?
Because you know, they might take it badly. Now, you know, I think the best book in terms of addressing this issue really is the Sacred Scriptures, because it's Christ that defines for us the nature of the church, and it's not something someone can go start in their basement on their own. Christ said to St. Peter, "You are the rock, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." And so we have to take Jesus at his word. Either Jesus is telling the truth and the church he founded has not been prevailed against, or he was a liar, in which case, why would we follow him anyway?
Sure.
And Christ founded the church, and it's still around. And so I don't need to go found another one. And we don't, you know, it's simple questions like, oh, you're starting a church. That's very interesting. The one I'm in was started by Jesus 2,000 years ago. It's still here.
Definitely a conversation starter. Appreciate that, Diana. Hope that's helpful for you. David, I think the takeaway here is a little love goes a long way.
Absolutely.
All the time. Let's go to Bruce now on Long Island, listening on Sirius XM 130 as well. Hey, Bruce, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. I just heard Dr. Anders give a summary of what he called Protestant soteriology. He didn't use the word, but that's what he's describing. The way Protestants, in his mind, think that they're saved. With all due respect, he was describing a very narrow band of Protestantism called dispensationalism. And I would just ask the doctor if he is aware that the historical evangelical position, the biblical position, is that actually eternal life is knowing God personally, where through a born-again experience, a person knows the Trinity through the Son by faith, and that faith always produces good works. If the doctor does not recognize this, then I challenge him to a public debate, and if he's not willing to public the debate, I'd like to know why.
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate it. So I know a few things about the history of Protestantism. I was brought up in the tradition and did my graduate studies in the history of the Reformation, so I'm familiar with the Augsburg Confession, the Westminster Confession of Faith, Philadelphia Confession, Theology of Calvin, Luther, Zwingli, Cranmer, Thurnan Articles, Heidelberg Catechism. I know something of history of American Evangelicalism, Whitfield, Wesley, Charles Finney, Asa Mahan, developments in the 20th century, fundamentalist, modernist controversy, evangelicalism, Carl Henry, National Association of Evangelicals. I know my history of the tradition fairly well, and I know that there is diversity within Protestantism. I'm aware of the history of dispensationalism that you discussed. So I do know there are these nuances. Now, I think in the call you probably listened to, the specific question I was answering was, where did the notion come from that to be saved is a kind of definitive moment, a consciousness in the Christian life? And why would someone who take that position believe that Catholics are not quote-unquote saved? That was the question I was answering. Not a comprehensive history of Protestant soteriology, but a narrow question about that particular spirituality. So I attempted to give a brief history of where that notion of certainty of kind of crisis moment in conversion came from historically, tracing it from Calvin through the Puritans into the First Great Awakening, Second Great Awakening, and the evangelistic crusades of D.L. Moody and later Billy Graham and also Bill Bright. So that's the history of a particular spirituality. I never claimed for a moment that was the only Protestant spirituality. I know there are many different Protestant spiritualities, many different Protestant soteriologies. Now, in terms of your characterization of the Protestant notion of salvation as a personal knowledge of the indwelling Trinity, you know, I would just point you to, I think it's Article 4 of the Augsburg Confession, where Luther gives his account of what saving faith actually looks like. And for Luther, at least in the Augsburg Confession, it is the belief that one is justified, the belief that one has been accepted by God, is itself the belief that saves. So a subjective certainty of one's own salvation, for Luther, is in fact the condition of salvation. All right. Now, you know, Calvin would give a slightly different account. Calvin put a stronger emphasis on what he would call union with Christ. that was certainly open to that notion of subjective certainty, such that by the time you get to the Westminster Confession, early 17th century, they hold out objective certainty as a kind of ideal, that everyone ought to have objective certainty that they are saved, whereas Luther would have considered that subjective certainty to be a condition. Calvinism would consider it to be more sort of a goal, all right? And did put a heavier emphasis on change of life, on moral conformity to Jesus as the evidence of that inward transformation. Now, you spoke about that moral transformation as being a sort of inevitable fruit of salvation. Of course, Luther and Calvin both would have maintained that serious moral lapses were consistent with election and regeneration. Both of them would have allowed for, you know, even gross sins like murder, apostasy, and adultery within the life of a believer that would not thereby separate them from the life of grace. So that's a key difference between traditional Protestant soteriology and Catholics. Because Catholic would hold there's such a thing as mortal sin. So grave sins like murder, apostasy, and adultery would in fact cut you off from the grace of God, whereas traditional Reformed and Lutheran theology would not hold that position. So there are nuances. I do recognize them. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear earlier. I was only trying to give the history of one particular spirituality, the one you called dispensational.
Bruce, thanks so much for your call. Here is Neil now. Neil's in Lynchburg, Virginia, listening on YouTube, a first-time caller. Hey, Neil, what's on your mind today?
Yes. I wanted to ask something about the difference in the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox Church. I became Catholic myself particularly after looking at the Church Fathers, and since both traditions do seem to have strong roots in the Fathers, What is it that would make someone choose Roman Catholicism over Eastern Orthodox?
Thanks so much. I appreciate the question. So I, in my case, the choice for Catholicism over Orthodoxy begins in the Christ's constitution of the Church. So Christ teaches that he will build the Church on the rock of St. Peter, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. When I look to Christ's rule of faith, how do I know the content of the faith? How do I know that I'm with the Catholic Church? The primacy of Peter is integral to Jesus' account of the Church's constitution. Now, the Orthodox churches that pulled away from the Catholic Church in the late Middle Ages articulated a different theory about the rule of faith, namely the ecumenical council. And that doesn't seem to be the teaching of Christ. The way you know you're with the Church is that you hold to the ecumenical councils. And, of course, that rule of faith doesn't really seem feasible. It doesn't seem functional either, because it raises the question, well, how do you know what an ecumenical council is?
Yeah.
Well, the Catholics have an easy answer to that question. I know the ecumenical councils because they're the ones that the Pope has acknowledged as being ecumenical, right? The Orthodox have a sort of circular account of that question. They say, well, the true councils are the ones that's held by the true Church. Well, how do you identify the true Church? Well, they're the guys that hold the true councils, right? So you kind of can't get out of that loop, right?
Yeah.
And there are competing claims to the title Orthodox. Mm. You got your Byzantine Orthodox, like the Greeks and the Russians. You got your non-Chalcedonian Orthodox, or so-called Oriental Orthodox churches of Egypt and Syria and Ethiopia and some of the South Indian churches. You got your Assyrian Orthodox churches, the so-called Nestorian churches that don't accept the Council of Ephesus, and they all lay claim to the mantle of Orthodoxy. But because they've abandoned Christ's rule of faith, they don't have an objective certainty in their own tradition. They just have fidelity to their own tribe, right, as their criteria of orthodoxy, but not one that's objectively verifiable. And thus, even within, say, the Byzantine family of Orthodox churches, I mean, try getting them all on the same page on anything. Every time they try to hold one of their own meetings, the Russians can't get along with the Greeks, and the Greeks can't get along, because they don't have an objective authority outside instituted by Christ that can rule on those sorts of things. And when I look at the sort of main theological differences that Orthodox have propounded, you know, like the nature of papal jurisdiction and so forth, they don't even stand their own criteria, right? Because no ecumenical council, that's their criteria, ever declared papal jurisdiction to be a heresy. Well, they call it a heresy. But their own councils don't say it's a heresy, right? So I just go back to the teaching of Jesus.
There you go. Neil, thanks so much for your call. Didn't have time to get to Michael in San Diego, but he has a very simple question. When did Protestantism begin?
With Martin Luther. He began the Protestant Reformation in 1517.
There you go. We answered that one as well. Dr. David Andrews, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
Don't forget, we do the program here on EWTN Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern, live Monday through Friday with a encore at 11 p.m. Eastern. Check out the podcast anytime at EWTNradio.net. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. See you tomorrow right here on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.